I'm bending your ear tonight. We'll all go around and just introduce ourselves, too.
And now?
Chris.
Gary.
I'm Jasmine.
Roberta.
Adam.
Diane.
Ruth.
Eddie.
Janet.
Gary.
Harry.
Elise.
Emily.
Michael.
There we go. Okay.
And Michael.
Yeah, well, I did that.
Oh, you're
yeah.
It. Okay.
So, yeah, we just, for everybody who's coming first or recently, maybe, I just wanted to just give you some kind of a little brief overview. We started this course. We're kind of in the middle of, or potentially, you know, we're underway. We'll put it that way. And the course is basically called Traveling from Confusion to Sanity, Interdiction to Buddhism 111. And we started with introducing the basic overview of Buddhism, Buddha Dharma itself, the teachings of Buddha, under the context, the path is the goal. Previously, we have studied the process of learning how to be in the body and working with your body in the process of meditation. And for anyone who wants to catch up with that, you can contact either of Michael, myself, or Emily, and we can bring you up to date. Also, the talks and the points of discussion are on the website. So, the basis of Buddha Dharma is, as is stated here, rediscovering our wisdom heart, fundamentally, that the nature of our mind is fundamentally awake, primordially awake, and positive, and basically beyond our concept of mind. Path. The journey happens within. So we're embarking on a journey. And in some sense, we're not simply trying to get on a journey where we're going to get off somewhere. We're actually embarking on a journey that the goal itself of our practice and our path is the path itself. We are not simply trying to get to arrive at some final point of finality or end, because there really is no final ultimate end in terms of that. And fruition is fundamentally to never feel like we ever have to go any further than where we are right now, that everything that we have ever needed or ever will need is right here and right now. And this is the nature of reality. What we want to do is to understand how we can truly be here fully and actualize our presence together for ourselves, for others, for the world, a phenomena, for all beings. Okay? Previously we were at a point where we began to discuss the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha basically presented the Four Noble Truths as a way of being able to, because it was the only way he could begin to understand how to relate to people who were so confused, because he had such a radical shift of understanding and realization that it wasn't as though he could just sort of start talking to everybody about it. He had no idea really what to say. And so he waited for people to actually interact with him. Friends, former colleagues, and people who knew him took him up and discussed things with him, and that pulled out the understanding of how he could begin to introduce what he knew, what he actually had gained to understand. We want to understand, first of all, the Buddha nature. The Buddha itself is our own Buddha nature. There was a historical Buddha, and we are fundamentally recognizing him, that person, Gautama Buddha, the person who established or gave the first Buddha's teachings, as the person who gave expression to this Buddha mind. But fundamentally, Buddha mind is inherent in all of us. And they even say that the Buddha mind is inherent in all sentient beings. It's not only human beings alone. But human beings have the unique capacity to wake up, because we can become dissatisfied enough with our experience that we can ask questions. And beings in other dimensions don't seem to have that capacity, at least as far as we know, the ones that we understand. So we introduced suffering. That was the first noble truth. And we have an outline for that and a review in case anybody wants to look at that. We just came from a discussion of the cause of suffering, which is the second noble truth. And we learned a little bit about that. It was certainly but not exhaustive, but more introductory in terms of understanding what is actually creating the suffering. But it's also very good. It's a very good foundation to begin to work on understanding how our mind works and how fundamentally the nature of our mind in its confused state is creating the suffering that we experience. And we're actually learning what it is, because it isn't as though we already know what suffering is. This is a very important point. The third point of the Noble Truth is that there is a possibility of the cessation of suffering, or a release or a liberation from suffering. And that's what I'm going to talk about tonight, and that will lead us into the fourth Noble Truth, which is that in order to discover or experience and understand and fully actualize that release, that cessation, we have a path. So we embark on this path. And so that is the basic proposal of what we are going to proceed on now. Just historically, the word for cessation in Sanskrit is nirodha satya. Or nirodha satya, between Pali and Sanskrit. It's the third of the Four Noble Truths. It means cessation or extinction. So nirodha means cessation, and satya means truth or reality. Nirodha satya is typically translated as the truth of cessation, the truth of cessation of suffering. And specifically refers to the cessation of suffering and its causes, and the experience of this cessation is called nirvana. Just as we began to previously understand that the fundamental cause and the state of affairs of suffering is samsara. It's not only suffering alone, what we would say, but its fundamental state of confusion, misunderstanding. So there are various aspects of this which we will go into now. But again, I could quote a few things just because I think some of these quotations are useful to help us understand. There is basically that. So one, these are quotes out of the very early Buddhist sutras that are just basically trying to describe the general nature of cessation. This is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha. The remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release and letting go of that very craving. We went into craving last week a little bit. Among whatever qualities there may be, fabricated or unfabricated, the quality of dispassion, the subduing of intoxication, the elimination of thirst, the uprooting of attachment, the breaking of the round, meaning the circular round of samsara, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, and the realization of unbinding is considered supreme. Those who have confidence in the quality of dispassion have confidence in what is supreme. And for those with confidence in the supreme is the result. Stilling, the hallmark of the goal. This is peace. This is exquisite. The stilling of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, the cessation, unbinding. Does that raise any immediate questions?
What's unbinding mean?
Well, we're unbinding from what we are bound with. And what we are bound with is what we are entrapped by, mm-hmm. which is basically our projections, our attachments, we even have a chair for her. our fundamental confused state of mind that is perpetuating itself endlessly through discursive mind, discursive thinking, and linking up one discursive thought after another. So as we meditate, we begin to get little punctuations of where we sort of see through that constant process of thinking one thought after the other, one state of mind emerging, one quirk, one feeling, one mood after another, we begin to sort of see some break. We do this when we, that's why we have an emphasis a little bit on the out-breath. Well, we say we become one with our out-breath, and we relax with that space, and we allow ourselves to experience a tiny gap before we simply start the in-breath again. And that is a basic kind of very simple introduction to space. And that space is where we can begin to have some sense of glimpse of just popping, that kind of sense of a chain link of constantly one thing overlapping into another thing, triggering another thing, which then starts another thing. So it's kind of a moment of awake, a moment of clarity.
Michael, there was something about supreme.
Supreme. Because this is considered, this state of clarity, of clear seeing, which we are introduced to actually previously into the notion of Vipassana, is actually leading us to understanding the nature of reality, and this is supreme. Knowing the nature of reality, knowing the nature of truth, actually experiencing that for ourselves, and living that truth in our life, that is the supreme of all possibilities. And it is also peaceful, it's one of the dimensions, because it is basically a state without argument. The Buddha said, I don't argue, it's not I who argues with the world argues with me. I thought it was an interesting kind of point. So he doesn't have a problem, or she, I don't, by the way, Buddha is not gender specific at all, let's be really clear about that. Buddha is simply our own true nature, so no sexual identity there. So yeah, we want to talk a little bit about just the nature of what this means. Let me see where I am here. Sorry. Backwards. It starts as fundamentally a glimpse. We're sitting here watching our mind crank out, and suddenly we have this kind of pop, you know, like stars in the daytime or something. It's not a common occurrence, let's say. It's sparse, it's sparse, it's minute, it's a flash. It's just a flash of openness, of clarity, and in that clarity, as we begin to get a little more familiar with it, we begin to realize it's fundamentally peaceful. So, because it's beyond argument. It's beyond having to settle scores or resolve issues. It's already done. It doesn't have anything to argue with in the first place. It's a sense of fundamental presence. So, the thing that starts to happen when we experience this is we start to go after it. We want more of it. You know? Well, that craving is a little different. This is something new. But, I mean, of course, it can turn into craving. This is more about a real flash of a real insight. The difficulty is when we try to catch it, we lose it. We can't grasp it. And our habitual mind pattern of mind is simply to try to grasp something, to latch on, put it in my pocket. Ooh, I can have it now. Sorry. It's completely gone the minute we try to take it. So it's just a state of openness. Openness can never be grasped. And this openness is the simplest way to understand, simply put, a simple way of putting this sense of peace. It's open. As we go further with understanding what this implies, we'll begin to realize that it has to do with the nature of reality itself, this fundamental openness. It's non-defined. It's not defined. It doesn't have boundaries to it. Now, because it has to be a personal discovery for ourselves, it's really something that is very genuine and something that has something to do with a knowing process. That's why it's not a learned process, a learned process, which you get from reading or absorbing or foisting on yourself. It's more of a fundamental discovery of what's there already. And it's been said fundamentally from that point of view, because Buddhism is eminently pragmatic and practical, that it's beyond mysticism, it's beyond religion, psychology, or any of those, or any kind of metaphysical kind of point of view. It's just about direct insight. So that's a huge relief. And you begin to realize how Buddhism is not a religion. You know, a lot of because it's locked together with other world religions, people just, oh yeah, it's a religion. But it's actually not a religion. And as we learn more about what it is, if it's anything that we could say as a body of practice that we engage with or dedicate ourselves to, it's more like a yoga on some level. And of course we know there's different kinds of yogas, but it's just a simpler way of putting it as a path.
Are you saying that because it can't be disciplined, it can't be turned into a discipline?
Well, I know the word religare, the Latin word, is to bind. That's the root word for religion. But I'm talking about organized religion, which has a catechism or an orthodoxy to it.
Or a set of beliefs.
A set of beliefs. It's not built on a set of beliefs. It's built on a set of direct insights. And, of course, there are certain points where I'm sure we will all encounter as we go further with Buddhism. You're going to find there are going to be different points of view or different takes and different understandings about what those direct insights are. But they remain what they are. There's fundamental core points that are absolutely run through all of Buddhism. And I think we've introduced a little bit of that already, which is one is egolessness. We discover fundamentally that, you know, we do not have a real ego. This is basically an invention. It's a construction, and it's a condition factor which we take on, absorb, create, and constantly modify. But fundamentally in itself, can't be found. It has no real truth to itself. So that is radically true. That's a radical truth that, you know, is unique to Buddhism.
But it doesn't mean anything until you discover it yourself. So in other words, nothing superimposed. There's nothing that's a set of beliefs that you have to sign up for or something. But it's a path of self-discovery. But there's guidance, you could say, and that's why these teachings are helpful, the Four Noble Truths, because somebody else went along the path first and discovered things, and basically it's helpful to hear what...
Sounds more like a philosophy.
Well, philosophy is... we could say that, a lot of people say that, but philosophy is fundamentally surrounded by concepts, and when we look at the basis for Buddhism, while there are certainly concepts employed, the basis is beyond concept, and the truth of the reality of Buddhism is beyond concept. And so that's why what we're discussing right now is fundamentally beyond concept. I mean, people can build on this. You know, you can have a religious experience or what we call a spiritual experience or some kind of insight, and then you start building concepts on it, and you build a whole structure. It could be a philosophy or a religion. But we're talking about something that continuously gets deconstructed every moment as we practice. We are continuously taking apart what we think, what we have just built up. What we discover is that we are constantly building things up, and in reality, this impermanence, which is so fundamental and so all-pervasive in our experience, is constantly reducing that, and so we have to keep on recreating it. Well, we stop that. So there's two factors here. When I say we're decomposing or deconstructing, it really is about this glimpse, this flash, this insight, which fundamentally pops that whole structure. And we're back to square one.
Does that make sense in any way?
I relate to that.
It sounds like a lot of like more recent philosophy, though.
Well, I'm employing certain... recent jargon simply because I happen to be contemporaneous and afflicted with having to use terms that some of us are familiar with.
I hear a lot of like Derrida and Foucault. If you've read them?
Who?
Derrida.
Yeah,
sure. Deconstruction is an
Well, that actually is an interesting term that came up recently. Deconstructivism is a philosophical system or school that developed in the between the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, particularly the last century, and it's built on the whole notion of deconstructing. But, you know, it doesn't really, it tends to place everything, it's sort of kind of a postmodernist approach.
It's like the very beginning of that. It's like trying to transcend concept.
Right.
That everything is what it isn't.
Yes. Just like existentialism had a flash of insight in the 1940s and 50s, you know, about basically just dealing with the fundamental presence of now. And, of course, people immediately start building on it. I mean, you immediately deal with fear, and you just solidify on your fear and build something out of it. That's how you define yourself. We talked about fear before as being something we don't want to build on. It's so fundamentally neurotic. It's the birth of neurosis, hope and fear. So we want to get out of that cycle. That's the recipe for suffering. We're going beyond that. We're taking it apart.
So if they're talking about Buddha nature that's inherent in us, is that our awareness of ourselves, or is there a fundamental energy below our awareness?
In reality, it's just awareness, but it's not awareness of. It's awareness without object. It's simple awareness. Now, you know, it's so hard for us to understand that notion because we always think of aware, and then we have to think of an object, because we talked about how our mind is always functioning dualistically, right? Mm-hmm. But we're talking about something that is kind of transcends or embodies, let's say, subject to object. It actually is bigger than that. It encompasses both. They're just little factors inside a process of perception, rather than being either on one end of the stick or the other. It's the whole stick. The whole shtick. So, let's talk about what we're dealing with here. We're talking about something fundamentally that's instantaneous and refreshed, or refreshing, and it's wakeful. This is what we're talking about when we talk about awareness. In order to understand that, we need to understand fundamentally that we have the reason why we're not understanding this in the first place, the reason why we are ignoring it, or we're bypassing it, because we're focusing on the state of confusion that we're very identified with, is because of that famous and very hopefully familiar term now, samsara. Samsara, right? And that's got three categories to it.
Maybe say what it is for new people? You're going to go into it.
That's what I'm going into, because, I mean, I know samsara fundamentally is a state of bewilderment. Well, if I talk too fast, then I'm going to jump. I'd just rather stay with this, because I'm introducing this in the context of, even though we've heard this term before, I'd like to introduce in this context of these teachings. Which, by the way, all of my teachings are, I'm hopelessly only simply a rather humble attempt to replicate the teachings of my teacher, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who introduced these teachings to the West very effectively. And actually, I took most of what I'm talking about tonight from the first volume of his Profound Treasury, if anyone's interested, we can talk about that later. But it's a comprehensive teaching of the entire Buddhist path. And this first volume has to do with Hinayana, narrow path. So that's what we're dealing with. Understanding samsara. Samsara is, in Tibetan, it's called korwa. Kor is circle. And korwa makes it a circle, like a verb, a noun verb. So it's like spinning, circling endlessly, like an ocean with tides. It's just constantly going, okay? So we have, did we introduce ground path and fruition already? We did, a little bit, yeah. So in terms of talking about this, in terms of introducing it as ground, this is a fundamental form of Buddhist logic. There's ground, path, and fruition. As you hear, you'll understand how it works. And I hope, but please, ask questions. So the fundamental question is the ground. Here we're looking at the essence. And the essence of samsara is bewilderment. So basically that means the opposite of what we call Buddha. Instead of awakening, Buddha is awakening from suffering. It's completely free from suffering. Samsara is fundamental suffering. Suffering from confusion. We talked about the nature of suffering earlier, and we have a fundamental kind of like outline of what all that, how that breaks down on the website. You're welcome to look at. So that means that now, that what's the cause of that bewilderment? We talked about that. Ignorance, a form of stupidity, but it's not stupid because it's lacking intelligence. It's because it fundamentally misses what's there and assumes something there that isn't. It assumes, like, for instance, continuity, which is actually, continuity is a total illusion. There is just discontinuity. As we meditate further and further, we begin to realize our thoughts are just a series of one discontinuity after another.
The tendency you talked about last week, by the way, I'd like to thank you for having the audio for last week. Whatever you expressed about tendency kind of inconsistency with this discreteness?
Consistent with?
Discontinuousness.
Yes, yes, exactly. The first skanda, we talked about the skandas last week, so the first skanda is fundamentally the point of, it's called form. Michael introduced it last week. What we actually find in the first skanda, which is basically this notion of, it's this little kind of flickering that starts happening in any given second, in just even a moment or a second, there, even in 300, 500 times a second, there's just constant birth, death, birth, death, birth, death cycle. This is something people have discovered who have spent a long time meditating. And then it starts this little disturbance. It's this fundamental sense of unease or if anybody wants to help, you're welcome to. This sense of fundamentally something off, and because there's something in us that wants, this is the fundamental point of ignorance, it wants continuity. It thinks something's here, and then it's not there anymore. I mean, this is happening all the time, just constantly.
It's like a pilot light flickering, I think there that's you go. Described
yeah.
somewhere.
Did
the Buddha say that? No. No pilot lights back in his day. But they did have candles. That was another image.
Yeah, a candle flickering in the wind. Flickering. So, okay, if I want to use Buddha...
The Buddha said it was like YouTube.
So...
Thank you.
In those days, they talked about prana, wind. Mm-hmm. Wind blowing across kind of open space and just stirring up energy. This wind blowing. Okay? It's very, very unconscious for the most part. Very occasionally do we actually see points where it's really clear in our mind. But it happens. And as we practice more and as we develop more of a sense of perception of what we call prajna, we can actually begin to see how this flickering begins, how this wind is blowing into the space and stirring up all these contents. It's trying to go faster than the way it is because it's disturbed, this notion that something was there and it's no longer there. If it speeds it up and makes it go faster, it skips steps.
Michael, what does this have to do with cessation?
Well, I'm trying to talk about samsara, but I'm taking too long about it, so we're going to move forward. I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay, second point, path or cause, the cause of this fixation. It's fixation or fascination. So we're fixating on something. That's basically what I was trying to get at. Grasping, operating on reflex, like going like a ping pong ball being bounced back and forth. And the fruition is fundamentally of this samsara is suffering. The aches and pains from being buffeted, being pushed around and brutalized by just the very kind of dynamics of our mind going all over the place, taking us back and forth. So the cessation is all about popping that cycle. And so what we talk about is meditation practice. Now, I can't remember this. We used this quote before, but brought it up. But Suzuki Roshi, who's this great Zen teacher, said, When we sit, we are the Buddha. He didn't say because you've been studying for 50 years or practicing for a long time or done retreats. He said, when you sit, you are the Buddha. That's it. So we learn through our meditation practice actually how to connect with this fundamental Buddha nature. We behave like a Buddha, Buddha through our shamatha vipassana practice. That's what's going on. And as we do that, we realize, we get insights into this samsaric mess we're in. Now, that's very good to actually have that. Even though you might feel terrible about what you see, it's extremely positive because seeing it is half the matter. If you realize what a mess it is, then you don't want to perpetuate it. There's a natural inner desire to drop it, to let go. It's not like I have to force myself to let go of things because I've been instructed. All I'm supposed to do is let go, let go, let go. But what am I letting go of? I'm letting go of my mess.
What does that have to do with cessation?
Precisely that. Mm. Letting go is cessation. In other words, this is how we discover cessation. We're discovering cessation directly through our practice. I can discuss a little more about the. What happened here? Oh, my pages. So we're talking about this as personal experience, and we have to have this as personal. We have to actually encounter directly these experiences for us to really actually discuss this personally. But I'm sure every one of us in this room who have been sitting for any time at all, even if you sat for a half an hour, has the possibility of having experienced this kind of momentary pop.
Does that mean coming back? What does the pop mean?
It means that between it's the space between the thoughts. Mm-hmm. The space between the thoughts is basically what suddenly gives us. We may not at first just even know what we're doing. We might notice at a certain point. Oh, I relaxed at a certain point. I don't know why, but it's like I'm not carrying that weight right now. It just dropped. So, hearing the descriptions about cessation, like we're discussing today, is good. But we don't want to fixate on either. We don't want to fixate on those qualities. We just want to basically understand them as possible cues. So if we think about how we are right now in terms of our own situation, it's more about recognizing that we're encountering this cessation as tiny specks of light in darkness. In other words, like twinkling little stars in Boston. When the sky is good, you can see a few, right? basically, these perceptions are basically going to help us motivate to embark on this journey of the Four Noble Truths. If we actually encounter suffering and we actually encounter something beyond suffering, we want to learn more about the causes. And so what was introduced last week, the cause of suffering, actually is going to be explored much further when we actually engage on the path. Because the path is all about uncovering continuously, unmasking the states of confusion and distortion or delusion. And so being honest about this, speaking for myself only, I will only speak, that I understand how deluded I am. I mean, I'm learning about it. I don't say I understand entirely, but I'm getting a good dose of it, through the practice, and it's really helpful. And so instead of feeling pushed out of shape or depressed about this, it's actually invigorating and inspiring because you realize that I have an opportunity to go through this. I have to see it in order to go beyond it, right?
So would you say cessation is only in meditation practice when you're actually noticing the thoughts and cutting them, or does it apply elsewhere too?
Absolutely applies elsewhere. We have post-meditation, and what we would call our vipassana practice is not confined to simply sitting on a cushion at all, but it's generated with a certain amount of stability through our meditation practice. And then it's our post-meditation practice where often these kind of gaps kind of start to occur. And we can actually encourage those gaps by just looking at where our thoughts come from at any given time. For our feeling, where do our feelings come from? Where do our moods come from? We're not trying to fix them. just like we talk about in our meditation practice. We're not trying to alter them, reshape them, make them nicer, but just simply see and drop it on the spot. Just
so is it like, you know, when you're talking about the skandhas, and it's sort of like you're sitting there and you're reacting to, you know, you sort of notice the situation, the person or something, and you have a reaction to them, and then you see the reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than doing that next step of like, oh, that person looks a certain way and I don't like people look that way, I'm going to move myself, you just think, I'm just going to be here.
Yeah.
Is that kind of that piece of...
It's seeing it and letting it go. Seeing it and letting it go. And every time I see it and let it go, it weakens its hold on me. So it's step by step. It's not a one-time shot where
right.
It's always going to go away just by my seeing it. But already it starts to weaken. So at Sarnath, when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, he taught it four times. He said, cessation can be experienced. Suffering should be known. The origin of suffering should be renounced. And the path can be understood as a resolution. So this is when he gave emphasis, each of those times he gave emphasis to each one of those different topics. So in this context of meditation as a path to help us understand this, because this is where we're going to encounter the cessation, is we recognize a contrast of samsara and nirvana. And we do this through our breathing instructions, just basically using our breath as this fundamental stabilizing factor and allowing the contrast to occur by itself. So it's sort of like seeing alternating currents of sanity, recognizing that, and then the confusion or the insanity which follows. And as we practice more, this kind of level, this starts to level out and the dots get closer, so that these points of flashes of insight actually begin to link up more with more continuity. So this is work. I mean, there's no question. This is what it really means to work on ourselves. But it's really good work. It's noble path. It's a noble work.
I wonder if people have any questions at this point about what's been said so far. And how that relates, yes.
Have you noticed that happening to yourself?
Yeah, so oh yeah.
Consciously aware that that's what's happening?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is something people who practice, I've been practicing, I mean, I'm not saying I'm mastering it, but I mean, I can't speak for myself when I say these things. I don't think I'm only reading what somebody else said. I certainly feel like the person who said it knew it a lot better than I did. But that's because he's my teacher. At the same time, I feel like this is borne out in my experience. I mean, I just don't want, I wouldn't simply want to parrot words that somebody else said if I didn't have, we didn't have, none of us who are giving these teachings to you want to ever be simply parroting words that we've heard and don't have any remote understanding.
So what is the cessation that the Buddha experienced? Is it a bunch of sparks? Or does it mean that samsara was extinguished, and what would that be?
Does anybody have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I got them. Would that mean or imply that the sparks get longer? In other words, when you think of the imaginary space of the space between your out-breath and the in-breath,
mm-hmm.
some transient space there. Well, in the advancement of your meditation, does that space get larger, so that ultimately the idea thing is that your constant awareness, the Buddha perfection, so to speak, would be that he's constantly in that space.
I think that's the point. That's the practice. The practice is to establish it. We need the meditation practice to ensure that we can renew ourselves, because our fundamental program has been, and you know, whether you want to accept the notion of former lives or just simply replication, endless replication of tendencies, habitual tendencies, our basic default mechanism is to fall asleep, to be absorbed in our thoughts and caught up with our own speed. And, you know, we're taking back our, we're coming back to our more original nature. We're coming back and rediscovering that. So that takes some discipline. I mean, that's the point of this path. We are in a disciplined path. It's, the Hinayana literally means narrow path, because it has to do with understanding that unless I'm willing to take responsibility for my being here, I won't.
If I could just add, Neil, in my own experience, my chasing after holding my breath is worthless.
Holding your breath?
Yeah. In other words, I'm going to stop. I'm going to force the gap. And like you say, you can't chase it, or you can't grab it.
What that this
the
is
holding
like,
the breath is the chasing.
And this is one of the difficulties when, aside from short periods, when you do what's called close placement in meditation, when you're simply breathing in, counting, you know, in, out, in, out. You can do that. It's helpful sometimes when your mind is really wild to just simply let it settle for a little bit. But if you do that all the time, you're suppressing the natural arising of your experience.
He's talking about holding his breath in meditation.
You're doing some sort of thing, which I just heard you say, but the meditation instruction we give is that you do not do anything to alter your breath.
Right.
You're not trying to change your breath.
You're not doing anything with your breath to alter it.
Right, but there's that piece of, there's the two pieces. There's the don't alter your breath, but there's this gap somewhere.
Well, but
and there's the piece of, the piece that's hard is, oh, well, the gap is where, like, I know what you're saying, Harry, like, yeah, that's where the action is. Like, how do I get to that gap? How can I get to the gap? And your mind sort of, you know, you're that piece of you that wants things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Says, oh, well, I'll just do a little bit and nobody will see because nobody's really sitting
I'll
like,
hold my
nobody's
breath.
Watching Harry breathe, you know. Yeah.
So we are basically offering the teaching, the meditation instructions that we got from Trungpa Rinpoche. You have encountered teachings from the Sakyam, I believe, also, because he gave teachings and he's supposed to be holding that throne right now, or that seat. And he talks about using the close placement. I mean, I know people can do that, and it's a traditional thing. It's not like it's something.
But you don't hold your breath.
No, you don't hold your breath, but you can count your breath. You're just, but holding your breath, you're fundamentally doing the same thing. You're trying to hold things down. You're just simply suppressing everything, and you're fiddling.
You're fiddling. Whether it's close placement or not, there's never an instruction of holding the breath.
I agree. Either. I agree.
Right.
And
well, we're not saying that anybody told us to do it.
Close placement is not the issue here. It's something, some gimmick which is coming up, which is altering, doing something with your breath.
Yeah,
it's more about it's more about noticing than it is about changing anything. So when you breathe out, you're just noticing that when you breathe out, there's a space there before you take another breath.
There's the manipulation.
You're not manipulating anything.
You're not taking the other breath.
You're breathing, but you're breathing normally. You're breathing normally. But there is a natural space there. It's nothing you're manipulating. You're noticing. You're just noticing. So you could just let go of that. You could change the instruction. You could just be breathing and maybe not even paying that much attention to the gap. Maybe you need to just
sometimes
let that go.
I think sometimes they're definitely necessary and perfectly fine. The point is that you don't try to change anything in terms of, like, you don't try to control the movement. You'll find that if you actually just use the instruction we have with being one with your out-breath, is that the out-breath allows you to release whatever's going on. We don't say be one with your in-breath or focus on that, because we want the in-breath also to be an opportunity for our natural experience to arise. We're not interested in holding anything down. So that's really important.
Yeah, I think this issue comes up because our breath is basically a mirror of our being, or it is our being. Mm-hmm. And given that we have a level of anxiety in our being, which I experience in myself, that manifests as wanting to keep breath in myself a bit. In other words, it's an aspect of not relaxing, actually, as I experience it. And maybe we sit down and we outlive it a little bit. Maybe not. Maybe one of the first things we become aware of is our anxiety that doesn't let us have release in our life. If so, I think we just have to see that and look at that and let it ripen itself.
Let it what?
Let it ripen itself.
Ripen itself.
Yeah.
For me, these moments of the blankness in your mind between thoughts, that seems to happen most at moments when there's just a lot of adrenaline going through me. When I've had some sort of a physically jarring experience, that's when, like, I'll just, as an example, about 4 years ago, I was in a pretty bad car accident, and in the moments right after, I mean, I don't want to go through that again, but, like, just, you're never more alive right after that, you know?
Yeah.
You're never more in the present moment. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't feel my legs, and I didn't realize that I'd broken my hand, but, like, I was just, you know, you're very, very aware of just being in that moment. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, this meditation approach seems like 180 degrees from that, of just physical tranquility.
Well, actually, it's amazing, because I had a couple of really serious accidents myself, and automobile accidents, and when the car got completely lost control and was heading into a crash, everything just stopped. You know, it's just amazing. It's just, you're not, there's no tension. The adrenaline rush comes after that. There is just this presence. Because this could be it. Who knows? Mm-hmm. And this happened to me about 3 or 4 times. And so I happened to be practicing at the time, and I could actually remember specifically the reference that of just being there. What else is there to do? You know, you're just there. There's nothing to do. And the freaking out or the emotional or responsiveness comes afterwards when you've actually hit it. And then, you know, you're jarred, and then you have that adrenaline rush, which certainly is present. But it's the before that moment when everything just comes to a complete, it's like this hush, you know, time stops, and you're there. You're there. I mean, it's complete presence. It's not like you've gone there. You're not dreaming about anything. So what we're getting at here is, fundamentally, in the practice, and how this translates, two ways. First of all, being in the sitting practice itself, and then later, in our post-meditation experience, simplicity. We're discovering some fundamental simplicity. We're discovering a stripping down to essentials. And in the process of this, and as we allow ourselves this opportunity, allow ourselves this tremendous potential to actually emerge, we discover a deeper comfort. We discover a deeper state of ease. And we discover actually that's there all the time and we have ignored it. It's underlying everything. It's there. But, you know, we need to know this for ourselves. We don't want to just try to assume anything at this moment. We just want to actually experience things directly. And that's the important thing. And the other thing is, even if we start with an ego-oriented approach, which is, I'm just doing this for to help myself and make me feel better, which a lot of meditation practices often do, they talk about all the glories of mindfulness and how it will help you conduct your business and other things like that, which is not untrue. People do it for improvement and for self-aggrandizement. Is the interesting, as Trungpa Rinpoche says, is that if you continue doing the practice itself, if you really follow the instructions, you'll find you're allergic to yourself.
Then what? You still have to carry yourself around.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, you realize, you know, like this is something you're discovering something else that's beyond me. So then it's all about how good I feel. It gets really old. You know, it gets really stale. It has no basis for it. The inspiration is going to wear really, really thin. And it doesn't. You can't stay with it that long at a certain point because it just gets too painful if you're doing it for me. Because you're still coming back to this fundamental reference point of how am I going to feel about me. And we're not talking about, when I'm mentioning this word of a deeper comfort or ease, we're not talking about it's me that this is about. It's about recognizing that it's simply that state of ease that is present in itself, as it is. So, I want to make sure we have some time to discuss this in terms of where we have come so far with our own experience. I could go on for another 45 minutes, but really it would be better if we really had a chance to sort of... would somebody like to discuss how they might have experienced some sense of flash of insight or some sense of cessation, begin to see how they could see how this could possibly be operating in their own experience? Or anybody want to share?
I'll start.
Yeah.
I'm Eddie, and I've had that feeling that I am becoming aware that I am becoming aware that there's a lot of feelings that interfere with, I can't say the quest for knowledge, but the fact that it's out there and I want to pursue it. And, we start this out with the meditation, and, I don't know if that helps me sort things out or it just gives my very active mind, a salad spinner to just mix things up in and, see what happens. But, then the discussion of the path, the Four Noble Truths and the cessation and the cause and, that kind of, it brings me back down to let me know that I really don't know. Becoming aware that you're becoming aware, mm-hmm. or realizing that you don't know what you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's doing for me. Thank you all for it.
Yes, Roberta.
I've been thinking a lot how important this is for you to do this lately. I sort of took the summer off because the summer was fun. Thought I'd play. But, then I started suffering and said, I better meditate. So, but in my life, right now, I volunteer at this daytime shelter with these people who are homeless and alcoholics and drug addicts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to not want to, just shake people and say, stop it. And I have to just, I can't try to maneuver them. I have to just let them be. And just be there with them. I can't fix it, even though I want to fix it really badly. Because as a physical therapist, I was taught, you fix it. So it's important for me doing that. And I also have a friend who's just been in terrible shape for a few years. And just hanging in there with her. I need to, she's very defensive and angry, and so I'd like to do more than just bite my tongue, and it seems like maybe with the meditation I could just accept the way the situation is and not feeling like I'm biting my tongue and forgiving her for being that way or tolerating her, which seems so condescending that I don't
So actually it's interesting because if you really do let go of those attempts to try to remedy the situation and really are there to it, when you say something, it will be far more effective in terms of, and appropriate in terms of what that person can do. Because you're getting yourself out of the way.
I'm trying, although, the meditation stuff is so hard because I don't want to feel my feelings. Don't want to do that. It's like this whole 3-hour thing that I'm going to sign up for sounds like some torturous sit here and feel my feelings and Emily's going to come fix my posture for 3 hours. My back is fused most of the way. Not like this. Oh no, people are going to fix me. But anyway, it's it seems very important in my life for what I'm doing.
I had an experience today. I teach high school, and I had a student who was very unhappy with what his grade was going to be, and I sort of had said, yes, they want, are not going to change it. He came, wanted to talk to me again. I said, okay. And I sat and sort of said, you know, I hear how you're feeling and understand that you're not happy with it, but I'm really not going to change it. And we talked a little, and then at some point he said, well, if you're not going to change that, then I have to change how I react to it. Mm. So 17-year-old kid, I was like blown away. I said, okay, and we just talked. And I don't want to take like great credit because I sat there and listened. I sort of went in sort of a little defensive, but if he wants to talk, it's not my job to say I don't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
But that he just said, well, then I have to. Mm-hmm. And then he could finally sort of come to say, I teach all these high school seniors and they're waiting to hear about college. And he said, it's so out of my control. I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't know how to make happen what I want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of, it's, they're like right in samsara there.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have control and I don't have it.
Right.
And sort of to be able to talk about just, you know, and that's really hard. I mean, he did this whole, you know, it makes me feel these different ways that I don't really like. It's just very powerful. I mean, I was just thrown at the 17-year-old and say, well, I have to change how I feel about it.
Well, also that you were available in that way enabled him to come to that realization. So that's really
giving him space.
Giving him
space.
Yeah,
it was just very nice.
I would like to, I like the, what was said tonight about anxiety. When I first started coming here and I started meditating, the first couple of weeks I had a hard time with it. It felt like, I know it was anxiety coming up, like I got dizzy, and the more I focused on my breath, the more I felt like I was controlling my breath and I didn't want to, and then I felt like I was losing my breath, and I was like, wow, I really, like, so much anxiety came up for me. It was really, really strange, really strange. And a couple times, like, the first couple weeks, I had to get up and leave and go into the bathroom and just put water on my face because I felt hot. And I really, it's like, whoa, what is going on? So I think something that was said tonight, and I can't remember what it was now, but that now it's starting to make sense because that feeling, I don't have that anymore. I somehow got through it. And it's really nice to come and be able to sit and not feel that anxiety. And it's like, oh, okay, where's that anxiety? It's just not even there. So I don't know what that was all about, but I think it's really, really interesting. And I am in touch with my feelings all the time. So it surprised me. That so much anxiety came up.
And that's what when we mentioned that first skanda, that's really the problem. The fundamental core problem is this anxiety that starts on such a subtle level. And, you know, when you can actually see it come up and actually, like, sort of surface, that's also the opportunity when it can be dropped, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have to hold on to it. You just let go of it. Let it come through. It has to come through. So you have to see it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In order for it to actually go beyond or just drop itself, just evaporate.
Yeah, maybe that's what happened. I didn't feel like I had to understand it. I just let it be.
One of the things that happens here, there's just a couple more minutes left, and one of the things that I just I saw a couple of things I just wanted to share with you here in terms of talking about. There's some different, it was actually noted something called 12 aspects of cessation, but I did want to just mention a couple. So we talked about nature, the nature of cessation, basically like going to a pure state beyond ignorance. And we learn how to actually fundamentally learn how to reduce our kleshas. So our kleshas, our emotional defilements or emotional neuroses, actually start to lessen. They start to iron out. They get even. They get boring. You know, they're no longer entertaining. Whereas before, we could really get fascinated and caught up with them. They actually begin to get, oh, that again, that guy, you know. I mean, like, so it's easier to actually give up when you sort of see that, because there's much less seduction and fascination around it. And our what happens is that by continuing to work on this, we develop a pliancy. This is a word that we'll encounter more and more. I mean, the current word is neuroplasticity. You know, pliancy, where you're fundamentally willing to go with what's happening. You're willing to work with what's happening. You're not going to become victimized by hitting the wall. You hit the wall, you'll move on. You know, you're not. It's a momentary experience. It's not going to be a disaster. Because what we're encountering all the time is challenges. And we're encountering constantly experiences of flow and resistance. And so what we do is we learn how to work with that, and we learn how to be much more open to that process and the learning process, rather than trying to hide ourselves from it or avoid any kind of bumps that we might ever occur, because the bumps are always going to be in the road. They're going to be there. They're just part of our road, you know. We can't anticipate them, but we can learn from them. So I realize it's now 9 o'clock. I certainly would like to have made this a little more concise, and however, I really appreciate the opportunity to share this, and we could even bring it up maybe next week when we talk again. We could, if you have questions, because there is further discussion here, certainly a lot more to discuss, and certainly in terms of your own experience and working with that as you will over time, please feel free to share that with all of us, because we're all learning together, and this experience is very important for all of us. Yeah,
will next week also be more on the cessation of suffering, or will next week be more about the cessation
well,
of suffering?
Well, maybe we can do something where we can translate the cessation, because the natural transition of here is to learning about what the ultimate way to work with that, and that is to embark on an Eightfold Path.
Okay.
We'll
everybody's
be working.
Yes.
Next week we'll be on the Fourth Noble Truth, which is the path. And it does tie in with the cessation of suffering.
Completely.
Sure.
So there's a natural continuity here. So we can go back and forth regarding cessation and the path. They are absolutely intrinsically connected, and they'll be mutually informative.
So be sure to look on the website. I'm not sure what I'm going to post on there yet, but just keep checking, and there'll probably be some material for next week that'll appear at some point.
Maybe a reading,
or an outline or something that you might contemplate. So we'll see what appears.
We'll see what appears. The woman is going to do it.
We'll see what appears.